Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
What does Geronimo say when he jumps off a cliff?
Me!
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano, and from APM, American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win your dinner parties.
You just got a joke from actor and writer Greta Gerwig that'll help break the ice. She contributed to a new literary collection called Worn Stories, and we'll hear more from her later. Plus, it's the 40th anniversary of the movie Young Frankenstein.
Hooray.
So we invited its director to come by and celebrate. Mel Brooks joins us to talk about his career and answer your etiquette questions.
It's going to be great. Also coming up, A.C. Newman, frontman of Canadian pop band The New Pornographers, shares a dinner party playlist, and we learn about North America's first cat cafe.
Bring your Claritin.
Indeed.
But first, as at any dinner party, we start with small talk.
All week, you've been hearing these headlines.
Joan Rivers, the famous comedian, has passed away.
A federal jury has convicted former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell and his wife Maureen of corruption.
NFL kickoff is upon us.
Now for a story you might not have heard. We are speaking with Rehan Harmansi. She is senior editor at Fast Company magazine. Rehan, what story are you going to be talking about at parties this week?
I'm going to be talking about a study about why you can't smell the smell of your own house.
I can't smell the smell of my own house?
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
Well, you know how when you walk in somebody else's house and you're conscious like, oh, this smells like Febreze or this smells like cooking. You walk into your house and it's just kind of neutral.
Oh, that's true.
Because my house is clean and perfect and I'm not gross like other people.
Yeah,
that's clearly not the case. So what's going on here, Rehan?
According to New York Magazine, it's a phenomenon called nose blindness.
Wow, I wish I experienced that phenomenon more often.
It would be more useful outside of your house.
I wish I had nose blindness in the subway, but I don't.
Yeah,
well, a subway is not a familiar environment. Apparently, we're set up to be more finely attuned to change. So as soon as something changes in your house, let's say a new air freshener or a rotting corpse of an animal, you're going to notice that, but not the resting state of your house.
But what's the reason for that, I wonder? Like, is there an evolutionary reason why we're more attuned to changes in scent?
Well, I think it's a survival thing. You know, you had to be able to tell before we had, you know, like fancy thermometers, whether or not food was safe to eat, for instance. So we are triggered by the smell of rotting food.
So it's about threat, basically. Like if a smell is new to you or if it changes suddenly, then it might be threatening and you notice it. But if you're not threatened by it, then you stop noticing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So is Febreze dangerous by eliminating all these, the scent of these threats? We're actually making ourselves vulnerable.
Good point.
It's like not wearing a seatbelt.
On your nose.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably going to be some regulations around Febreze soon. I think it's a priority.
Finally. All right. Rehan Harmansi, thanks for the small talk.
Thanks so much, you guys.
And now let's inhale some cocktails. Once again, we tell you something that happened this week in history, then give you a fitting drink to serve along with it.
It's like history is the mighty Amazon, flowing with booze.
Ooh, there goes the rainforest. Let us start with the history. This week back in 1878, the first of a new breed of American worker was hired.
Our friend Michelle Philippi tells the tale.
Almost as soon as there were telephones, there were telephone operators. And they did more than plug wires into switchboards. See, when the first phone companies launched in New England, phone lines were noisy. Operators not only had to quickly connect callers, they were expected to monitor the calls and help out if the callers couldn't understand each other. The problem? The first operators were teenage boys who developed a rep for being, well, kind of jerks. They were impatient. They cursed. The solution seemed obvious. Replace them with girls. On September 1st, 1878, Boston's Telephone Dispatch Company hired the first female operator, Emma Nutt. She liked to joke. She was glad her first name wasn't Ima. In addition to that sense of humor, Emma also had a pleasant voice. And unlike the male delinquents who preceded her, Emma and her fellow women didn't have many other career options. So they put up with a lot more hassle. Soon, America's switchboards were all run by female operators. It wasn't a cakewalk. Operators work 12-hour shifts, for which they earned a measly 10 or so bucks per month. And as an early operator named Marie McGrath told PBS, it was a less-than-nurturing work environment.
Very, very strict at the board. No talking, no, don't dare look around. If you moved your head, you'd have five supervisors at your position. You could only use certain phrases. Number, please, and thank you. The customer could say anything they wanted to you, and you would say thank you. You're a stinker. Thank you.
Still, Emma Nutt seemed to make peace with her gig. She worked as an operator for over 30 years and was said to have memorized the entire New England phone book. A century later, a telecom company started offering what was basically an automated virtual phone operator for offices. They named the system Emma.
So that was the history lesson. Now for a drink to go along with it, I am joined by Naomi Levy. She is bar manager at Eastern Standard in Boston, Massachusetts, the city that Emma Nutt worked on the switchboard. Naomi, what cocktail did this story inspire you to make?
This story inspired me to make a drink that I am naming the switchboard. There is no more appropriate name. For this cocktail, what I wanted to do was kind of switch up a cocktail that some of us may know about, the Marconi Wireless, which is actually named for another pioneer in early communication.
Of all the people to get their own drink, you know, you would think like Frank Sinatra would have a drink, but Marconi.
Right. And I believe it was actually invented at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. It was believed that he stayed there during one of the times that he got an award, and this was his drink of choice, essentially an Applejack Manhattan.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, we are going to switch it up for the switchboard. We're switching it from essentially a Manhattan variant to a Negroni variant.
Wait, why didn't they get a Marconi Negroni? I mean, that's really what they should have given
him. I don't know. Right, he was Italian, too. That would make sense.
Yeah, exactly. The Campari, the rhyme, it was just right there.
It really was. You know what? That's going to be the next drink I come up with.
All right.
So the switchboard is 1.5 ounces of Laird's Bonded Applejack. That's going to be the 100-proof stuff.
Okay.
With 0.75 ounces of Cookie Americano, which is our vermouth, as well as 0.75 ounces of Aperol, being our bitter orange in there. Give that a nice stir, and we're serving that right over the rock.
And wait for it to connect to your brain.
Exactly. Sip slowly, enjoy it. It's definitely a nice kind of little bit more of a feminine drink versus the Marconi Wireless. We're trying to make it something that Emma would hopefully enjoy after a long, long day at the switchboard.
You want to make something that Emma would be nuts about.
Right.
So, Brendan, here's some trivia.
Okay.
According to some accounts, the phone companies preferred hiring women with long arms because they needed, apparently, to reach the top of the switchboard easily.
Gotcha. This must have decimated the synchronized swimming industry back in the day, you know?
I'm sure it was catastrophic.
Yeah,
for
that's why they came up with the golden swim cap.
Oh. You know,
to lure people back.
It's enticing.
Into the pool.
You got my attention. People, we have drinks for folks with any length of arm. Mm. You'll find all our recipes at dinnerpartydownload.org.
And now, time to eavesdrop.
Writer, actor, and returning guest Greta Gerwig starred in the indie film hits Greenberg, Damsels in Distress, and Frances Ha. The latter earned her a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actress. She also co-wrote it. Today we overhear her contribution to a new literary collection to which she lent a story and the shirt off her back.
I'm Greta Gerwig, and I'm going to read a story I told to Emily Spivak, who made this book called Worn Stories, which is a piece of clothing that means something to you that you have a story about or a feeling about, and this one is mine. Twelve years ago, I was working as a stage manager at a theater company in Vermont for the summer. I was the worst stage manager of all time. Around this time, I figured out that I could fall in love with people and that I could be in love. I was already in love with one person, and I started falling in love with lots of people. I felt very guilty about it, but It also felt like an appropriate response to figuring out you can be in love. I was in love with love. In high school, I would have these horrible crushes on people, but they were never reciprocated or the people were gay. Then in college, I had the experience of looking into someone's eyes and saying, I love you, and he said, I love you, back. So I had this crush or love for this actor at the theater in Vermont. His name was David, and I thought he was so beautiful. He had this very soft button-down shirt. When I hugged him, and I would always invent reasons to do so, I would touch his shirt. It was very chaste. Nothing ever happened. I was in love with him, but he was 26 years old, and I was 18, and when you're 18, 26 seems really old. David left that summer before I did. We took him to the bus station, and I cried because I was 18 and dramatic. I watched him go, and I felt bereft. My friends and I returned to the falling apart cabin in the woods that had been our home that summer. I went to the room where I had a bunk bed. Hanging on my bunk was that button-down shirt. His shirt. Tucked inside the shirt pocket was a note. He told me I was beautiful and a creature of light. Doesn't that just kill you? Can you imagine an 18-year-old girl coming back from the bus station to her room and seeing that the guy she loved had left his shirt for her? He knew. He just knew it. And it was beautiful. I always write while I'm wearing this shirt because it makes me feel like I have a secret. When you write, it's good to have a secret because, in a way, you do. You have to nurture the secret until other people know about it.
Actor and writer Greta Gerwig reading her contribution to the new book Worn Stories. It's a collection of sartorial memoirs. The project is the brainchild of Emily Spivak. You can hear Emily's story about a pair of flip-flops at our website.
Enrico, I was thinking my story would be about this little red blazer I had when I was 10.
Aww.
And I called it my tuxedo. And I'd be allowed to wear it only when we went out to dinner, where I would drink Sprite martinis.
Oh, you were a young... Wait, isn't a Sprite martini just a Sprite?
If it's made correctly.
All right. That's a good,
yeah, dry Sprite martini.
No vermouth in that.
It's important. All right, coming up, folks, comedy legend Mel Brooks, and he wants everyone's full attention.
If you make noise, we will kill you.
When the dinner party download continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, Public Radio's Arts and Leisure section. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. In a few minutes, A.C. Newman, frontman of the band The New Pornographers, analyzes the lyrical genius of the Doobie Brothers.
There's no real lyrical hook to remember except for the line, "What a fool believes."
You will never hear that tune the same way again. And later, we will learn about the newest thing in coffee culture, cats. But first, let's meet our guest of honor.
Yes, and joining us this week is Mr. Mel Brooks. He began his career in stand-up and as a writer for Sid Caesar's groundbreaking TV comedy series, Your Show of Shows. He went on to form a duo with one of the show's writers, Carl Reiner, and scored a massive hit with their routine, The 2,000-Year-Old Man. Mm-hmm. And then Mel went on to write and direct what are considered some of the funniest movies ever, including The Producers, Blazing Saddles, and Young Frankenstein. This year is the 40th anniversary of that parody of classic monster movies, and a new edition is being released on Blu-ray on September 9th, the day after he sticks his hands and feet in wet cement in front of Hollywood's famed Chinese theater. And Mel, it's an honor to have you.
Why, look, you know, Brendan.
Yes?
You've covered it. I don't have to talk. That's it. you've said
great.
All right.
You've said everything I was going to say.
It's been nice having you.
And even, you could say bigger and better things about me, but that's okay.
Well.
Let me help you a little bit.
Okay.
You say, I can't effing believe who I am talking to.
That's true,
this
actually.
This guy is an effing legend. When I left the house today, A neighbor said to me, isn't that guy dead? And I said, well, I don't know. I hope not. I'm going to talk to him in 10 minutes.
But you bring up a good point. You are a legend. R2-D2 is a fictional character. He has his feet in the cement in the Chinese theater, and you don't?
Well, I'm really a little worried about it. I heard that Jeanette MacDonald, who she was a very famous opera singer.
Yes.
She was in a great movie with Clark Gable called San Francisco.
Right.
Yeah.
And but I heard when she got her hands and feet in the cement, she actually got stuck. And they had to, they had to cut her shoes away to get her feet out.
Oh, no.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, yeah, so I'm wearing my cheapest shoes in case they have to be cut away.
Yeah, or just coat them with butter that they just slide out real easy after you're done.
Okay, well, I don't know. Olive oil may be cheap.
All right.
But I'll coat them with something. That's a good idea.
So we want to play a clip from Young Frankenstein, which you co-wrote with your star Gene Wilder.
Hey, everybody, come in here. They're going to play a clip from Young Frankenstein.
But there's too much good stuff to choose from. So we'd like you to pick what's your favorite, ideally non-visual, gag in the movie.
You know, one of my favorites has a great pause in it. It's Marty Feldman at the dinner table. It starts actually with Dr. Frankenstein saying, reputation, reputation. He's so unhappy because his experiment didn't work. The monster did not come to life.
Yeah, Frankenstein monster.
And then Marty Feldman, who plays Igor, says,
you know, I'll never forget my old dad. When these things would happen to him, the things he'd say to me.
And then he didn't talk. You know, so we all waited. I don't know whether Marty Feldman, as Igor, was using the right tempo, taking his time, or simply forgot what he had to say next. We waited 2 minutes. And then Gene said, what did he say?
What did he say?
Marty says something like,
what the hell are you doing in the bathroom day and night? Why don't you get out of there? Give someone else a chance.
It's the craziest scene. It was very difficult. I got to tell you guys a secret.
Yep.
Okay.
The minute we started shooting, the crew, you know, the grips, and the sound people and the camera people, you know, they break up and you could hear them laughing, you know, they try to muffle it through their fingers. So the first day I sent someone out, sent the assistant director out, and I literally, this is all true, and I said, go to a department store and buy 1,000 handkerchiefs. So he went out and he bought 1,000 white handkerchiefs. And I said to the crew, every time you got an urge to break up, to laugh, stick this white handkerchief in your mouth. And every once in a while, when I knew things were funny, I would turn around, I'd see a sea, maybe 1,000 white handkerchiefs. And I'd say, okay, this is going to be a hit. And in this one, we all lived with white handkerchiefs in our mouths with this scene. It was just, it was amazing. So
is it your favorite scene because it's hilarious on the page and on the screen, or because of that moment off screen, do you think?
It's a combination because, first of all, it has nothing to do with the problem of creating a living human being from inanimate pieces taken from the graveyard. Nothing to do. What does get out of the bathroom, give someone else a chance, have anything to do with what the experiment that was going on in Frankenstein's castle?
It's absurd. It's
it's
good.
Absurd. Yes. That's what I love. I love everything that's absurd.
So, Mel, this, like so many other of your films, is a parody. You know, with your TV series Get Smart, you parodied the spy genre, Blazing Saddles the Western, Young Frankenstein the horror film. What attracted you to parody?
You know, the frames of reference. The kids would understand what I was doing. Once they'd seen the picture, especially Spaceballs, once they saw the picture,
the picture you're satirizing,
they knew what the takeoff was, what the satire was.
Yeah.
So it made things a lot easier than creating. Let's say I did a movie later on called Life Stinks, and there were no frames of reference. It was just if you were very poor and you lived in urine-filled alleys somewhere in a bad neighborhood, you'd understand what the movie was about. But I wanted to say something about, I don't know, about the inequity of life, especially in big cities. So, and it's more difficult, and they won't be as successful as Spaceballs or any of the parodies. And, you know, Blazing Saddles was easy. It just, I had seen 1,100 Westerns as a child.
Yeah.
So it was just, I knew every cliche, you know, from sitting around a campfire eating beans. to a brawl in a Western bar. And,
so basically, it was just easier for you.
It was easier. It was more fun. It was more fun, yeah. Actually. Nothing is easy.
You actually bring up a good point. You know, for a lot of people of my generation, some of the earliest comedy that captured our imaginations you created, you know, you mentioned making these parodies that kids could understand. But I still find this stuff funny as an adult. And I still think kids today react to your work, Spaceballs especially. I know my friends' children love that movie. What is the secret of appealing to all ages, just having that frame of reference? What do you think?
You know, you got to make the kids laugh. Kids are not into irony. They're not into satire. But adults are. So it's got to be satiric and ironic for adults, and it's got to be simple and silly and funny and fun for young people. It's a very thin and tough line to walk, but I'm a bit of a genius.
There you go.
So I was able to walk it.
You're a tightrope walker.
Yeah.
So speaking of your genius, you not only think you're a genius, but let's take 1974, the year Young Frankenstein came out. Blazing Saddles came out. It was the second highest grossing film of the year. Young Frankenstein was the third highest grossing film of that year. What do you remember about that period of your life? Because it must have been a bonkers year in the Brooks household.
Well, I mean, we bought a car.
Crazy.
And, you know, we just bought it outright, didn't have to make down payments. I mean, we got over $10,000.
Wow.
Coming in from both movies.
No plastic on the seats or anything.
No. So, yeah. No, actually, no one goes into this business for money. Maybe people who invest in studios, you know, stock and stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe they go.
The money men.
The people who entertain, the people who write, the people who make jokes, they're in it for applause, for laughter, for love. And they don't give a damn how much money there is in it. Their agents care, managers care. You know, and some, you know, some girl living in Cincinnati on the side, their wife doesn't know about, she cares. But generally, the people give their heart, they give their soul, they give their everything because they have to and they love it.
Yeah.
And the joy they get is the audience cracking up, going wild, applauding, laughing.
But in 1974, aren't you getting more of that reaction than you'd ever got before, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it, you know. When I did The Producers, that was back, it opened in 1968, I would go into the Fine Arts Theater and count the house just to see how many people had come in to see it that night.
Wow.
It didn't do badly, but it was just thrilling to see people online who couldn't get in to see Young Frankenstein or to see Blazing Saddles.
There were some ugly things going on in the world when you were coming up in Hollywood, the Vietnam War, et cetera. There still are.
Oh, yeah.
How do you keep your sense of humor in the face of...
I think one sense of humor is not acquired. I think it's genetic. I think it's a gift. I think when I was a little kid, the fourth boy of four boys, and my mother was... I don't know, she was just joie de vivre. She loved life. I had a great mother, and she infused me with kind of a joy and happiness, always whistling, always singing. I remember when I was a little kid, I was only 4 or 5 years old, going to school. It was winter. My mother was a saint. She would put my little clothes on the radiator. She dressed me under the covers so that I'd be warm when I popped out of bed.
Oh my God.
And she had Bing Crosby at some 15-minute radio show every morning. Sweet Georgia.
How could you not be happy?
That sounds delightful.
So she was really, I don't know how she survived without her husband, without her man for all those years, never remarried and raised her kids. And so I think she was the heart and soul of my joy, you know. And then I was lucky enough to be married for 45 years to Anne Bancroft, who was the same kind of person. I mean, you know, some crazy, fast, fat swaller, weird song would come on the radio and Anne would break into a dance. I mean, just like my mother. I had two of the greatest women in the world. So that's the reason for my joie de vivre, my joy.
Did she also dress you in bed, Mel?
Yeah.
Also, oh,
she
that's
did.
Great.
She did, and undressed me.
Oh, books. This week marks the 40th anniversary of Young Frankenstein. It's being re-released on Blu-ray. Plus, next week, Mel will put his footprints in the cement in front of the famed Chinese Theater.
And if you find yourself in Hollywood next week, he might still be there, stuck to the ground.
It's a possibility.
So if you see him, you know, give him some water, sympathy.
Yeah, and a smile. But meanwhile, stick around because Mel will be back in a few minutes to answer listeners' etiquette questions. You are listening to The Dinner Party Download from American Public Media.
No gal mate has got a shade on, sweet Georgia Brown. Two left feet, but oh so neat.
So we've sipped cocktails, met our guest of honor, but it's still not quite a dinner party till there's music playing.
And here with suggestions is A.C. Newman. In addition to a robust solo career, he's the mastermind behind Canadian supergroup The New Pornographers. So he knows a thing or two about keeping a crowd happy. We figured he's just the guy to spin us a party playlist.
Hi, this is A.C. Newman from The New Pornographers. We just put out a record called Brill Bruisers a few days ago, last month, who can say... And this is my dinner party soundtrack. The first song I wanted to play at my dinner party was called With Us Soon by Doug Tuttle. It's a record that came out early this year. Doug Tuttle used to be in a band called Moss with two M's. M-M-O-S-S. It's sort of mellow. Nice entry music. I'd say it's got a very classic, like, late 60s Birds feel to it, without being decidedly retro. Like, when it's nothing but the retro stylings and no song, that really bugs me. But when somebody knows how to sound like Birds circa 1969 and they can knock it out of the park, I love that stuff. It's a strangely obscure record. Like, it's one of those records I listen to and I think, why is this not hugely popular? You know, sometimes you want to convince your friends of new music and they won't listen to you. If you have them captive at a dinner party and you put on this record, then I think you could reach them. The second song I would play at my dinner party would be You Better You Bet by The Who. You Better You Bet is my favorite Who song. I'm not saying it is the best Who song. It came out when I was a kid. It was on the radio. So I tie You Better You Bet into a time when I was like 8 years old, where like music on the radio sounds magical to you. The lyrics are verging on terrible, but Pete Townsend, guitar player, head songwriter, was so confident in what he does that he didn't second guess himself, and that's what makes the lyrics so great, and that he puts a line in there like, you know, I've been wearing crazy clothes and I look pretty crappy sometimes. If I wrote that, I would put a line through it and go, no, no, you're not putting that in the song. But he put that in the song, and Roger Daltrey just yelled it with everything he had, and it's brilliant. I guess I would play this at my dinner party because there's a part of me that just wants to annoy my dinner party guests with this conversation, which is not a conversation, it's a monologue actually, where my dinner guests would stare blankly at me while I pontificate on the genius of Townsend's lyrics in You Better You Bet. I think there would be a few people like saying, excuse me, our babysitter just texted me, I think we have to go. The last song I would play at my dinner party would be What a Fool Believes by the Doobie Brothers. Just because, hey, everybody loves What a Fool Believes by the Doobie Brothers. It's got that dun 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 dun, which, if it wasn't the first song to do that, it was the first to really nail it. Because I know Robbie Dupree's Steal Away. Why don't we steal away? Dun 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 dun. I don't know which one came first, but they're definitely of a similar school.
He came from somewhere back in how long ago.
A friend of mine did What a Fool Believes at karaoke very badly, and I realized, wow, these lyrics are very asymmetrical. It's a long run-on sentence.
Once in her life, she musters a smile for his nostalgic tale. Never coming near what he wanted to say.
There's no real simple, like, lyrical hook to remember, except for the line, What a Fool Believes. But it's a song that just lodged into my head. It just reminds me of, like, collecting baseball cards. And, you know, I think at some point in my life, maybe I thought I was too cool for school and that I didn't like music that sounded like Michael McDonald. And then you come back to it and realize, no, this guy has got the most killer voice. If I was going to play one of our songs at my party, although it's something I would never do, I would pick Brill Bruisers. A straight down the middle rock song. It's not as interesting as You Better You Bet. It's actually got closer ties to We Will Rock You, actually. In fact, when we first started working on it, I think its working title was Rock You, because at the heart of it, it's got this pulse very similar. It's got this boom, boom, tang, boom, boom, tang.
Party soundtrack from A.C. Newman. This is the title tune off Brill Bruisers, the new album from his band, The New Pornographers.
All right, coming up, we find out what happens when you mix cats with cappuccino.
Fun.
Besides alliteration. And Mel Brooks returns to offer etiquette tips, whether he knows it or not.
Etiquette? This is an etiquette segment? Is this what we've been doing?
That and more when the Dinner Party Download continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. In a few minutes, we'll hear a brand new tune from Mary Timoney and her new band X Hex. And coming up, we virtually visit a cat cafe.
I keep saying that. That's different than a cat house, right?
It's way different. It's
all right.
Legal.
Okay.
For one thing.
Okay, great. But is it right? I mean, having cats in cafe?
We'll hear about
I guess
it.
We're going to find out. But first, it's time for our weekly etiquette lesson.
Yes, each week you send in your questions about how to behave, and here to answer them is, once again, Mel Brooks. We spoke to him earlier in the show about the 40th anniversary of his classic film Young Frankenstein, which will be reissued on Blu-ray this week. And Mel, we figure the guy who wrote the gaseous bean-eating scene in Blazing Saddles would be just the perfect person to adjudicate matters of etiquette.
Seemed like a natural fit.
You ready for these questions?
Ready for your submissions.
Okay. This first question comes from Saba in Encino, California. Saba writes, if I make a joke that offends someone, what's the best way to go about apologizing without making it even more awkward?
Mm.
If you make a joke that offends someone, the best way to go about it is to get into your little yellow Volkswagen, slam the door, and drive away. That's the best thing. Now,
right.
If you make a joke that offends somebody, what I say is, please forgive me. Sometimes I say, I'm from Brooklyn. I don't know.
What can I do?
Yeah.
Blame it on your upbringing.
You're right. Blame it on your upbringing.
Okay, that's good. Okay. If you're not from Brooklyn, just say you're from Brooklyn.
Right.
That's right. She's from Encino. Encino's kind of like Brooklyn, isn't
Encino
it?
Encino is the furthest thing ever created from Brooklyn, but I don't want to go into that.
So just lie, Saba.
Right.
In Encino. Okay. Here's something from Alexis. She wrote us via Facebook. We're not sure where she's from. Alexis writes, what is the biggest faux pas in history, according to the 2,000-year-old man? Now, for those who don't know, this, of course, was your character who was supposedly 2,000 years old and would be questioned by your sidekick, Carl Reiner.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say the biggest faux pas in history, according to the 2,000-year-old man, would be to say Gesundheit when somebody farts instead of burps. I mean, yeah, that would really be a faux pas.
That would be. That would be awkward.
It would really be wrong.
Yeah.
Is that a faux pas or just some sort of...
No, that would be just a tiny stupidity.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go, Alexis.
Yeah, the worst thing that's happened in 2,000 years. Yeah.
Our next question comes from Gail in Pasadena, California. Gail writes, if you have season tickets to four concerts And at the first one, the people behind you are obnoxious, crackling rappers and whispering constantly. What's the best way to shut them up without creating enemies behind you at concerts 2, 3, and 4?
That's really difficult. It's really not in my domain to figure those things out. But I, you know, in the old days, we would just take an old-fashioned bottle of seltzer and just spray them with bubbly water until...
Yeah. It sounds like that might create the enemies that you're trying to avoid creating.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, at concerts 2, 3, and 4, just write, if you make noise during the concert, we will kill you. Write it on a card and have it on your back.
Yeah.
So maybe it'll get to them.
All right. Although, actually, it occurs to me that if Mel Brooks squirted me with a seltzer bottle, that would make me delighted.
That's... Exactly. I would come back to the concert excited every time.
Yeah. I hope it happens again.
Yeah. It could be. I like that.
All right.
Rico from Los Angeles.
Yes.
You know, do you know Little Caesar, the movie with Edward G. Robinson?
Yes.
Do you know the movie well?
Not very well.
Probably not as well as Mel Brooks.
Yes.
Well, do you know what happens when Rico's riddled with machine gun bullets and is dying?
Oh, yeah. What is the line?
No, there is a line.
Yeah, what is it?
Mother of God, could this be the end of Rico? That's Edward G. Robinson's line.
That's going to be on my gravestone.
Yeah.
It will be the end. Yeah, it'll be Mother of God, that is the end of Rico.
So here's a question from Opus in New York City.
Right. Tell Opus that there is a fabulous wine that the Rothschilds make.
That's right.
In the Napa Valley called Opus One.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
That is really, it's a little too expensive, but it's really an incredible wine.
Well, we'll see if Opus serves that from now on at his home.
Okay.
But he writes, how does one best react if one accidentally breaks wind loudly at one's dinner party and one's fellow guests are slightly more fussy than those in the campfire scene from Blazing Saddles?
Oh, that's a good question.
A lot of people asked a version of this question.
That's what you're thought of.
Yeah.
When they think of Mel Brooks.
I think you should do what I do sometimes. Turn to somebody near you and say, what's the matter with you? Can't you see we're all, there's a bunch of people here?
You uncivilized heathen.
Just really turn the tables very quickly. Blame it on somebody nearby.
Offload the guilt.
Right, immediately.
Like, what is your problem? We're here enjoying nice Opus wine.
Are you from Brooklyn or something?
Good. I like that. What's the matter with you? Are you from Brooklyn?
I like that.
Okay.
All right, so our next question comes from Gabriel in Beacon, Iowa. And Gabriel writes,
wait a minute. Beacon, Iowa?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is this a surprise to you that such a place exists?
Yeah, there is a bit of a surprise. I don't think there is a Beacon, Iowa.
I agree with you.
I think Gabriel made that up. I think Gabriel's probably from Brooklyn. And he heard all the fun we're making of Brooklyn. He switched.
Oh, yeah.
He switched his hometown quickly.
Quick switcheroo to Beacon.
Sounds like a Brooklynite to me.
Yeah. Well, wherever the heck Gabriel's from, he's a liar, so we can barely trust his question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
And Gabriel writes, while riding in my friend's car on an empty highway, he stays in the left passing lane no matter what. When cars approach from behind, he won't move over, and he complains they're tailgating. His rationalization is he's going the speed limit, and other cars shouldn't be allowed to pass because that means they're speeding. How do I go about not losing my mind and get him to move over? As a side note, he doesn't like receiving driving advice. One of these guys, left lane
slow drivers,
sitters.
Person like that, you got to keep out of the car. I think what you got to do is, when you're having dinner with his friend, put something in his wine or water. Keep him sleeping. Keep him out of the car. Just knock him out. Keep him sleeping.
So roofie Gabriel is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Is the answer.
Slip him some lewds. You got, I don't know.
That's the polite thing to do.
Right. Remove him from the car.
Okay.
There you go. Here's our last question, Mel. And it's a question we ask everyone in our etiquette segment.
Etiquette? This is an etiquette segment?
Yeah,
is
believe it or not.
Is this what we've been doing?
Not really anymore.
There hasn't been a shred of etiquette in anything you've asked and anything I've replied.
Here's your last chance to redeem this segment.
Okay.
The question, and we ask this to all our etiquette guests, what's the most memorable get-together you've ever been to? Who, what, and where? Details, please.
There was a fabulous get-together last Friday in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, at PS19 for the celebration of all the kids who went to PS19 graduation in 1931.
Wow, it was a reunion.
It was a great reunion. I was all alone. There was not a single person in that reunion but me. And I put on a party hat, and I drank orange soda, and I had a cupcake.
Oh, wow. Sounds like a good time.
A candle. I mean, it was fabulous.
Well, you were in great company.
Mel Brooks, thank you so much for coming by, chatting with us, telling our audience how to behave, and making these wonderful films.
Thank you, guys. This has been a pleasure, really.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far.
Comedian Mel Brooks, one of the few people to ever win an Oscar, an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony.
Man. That's I think right. When that happens, they melt all of your statues down and just give you a big square block of gold.
It's a blocky.
That's right. You don't even need a trophy case. You just use it as the cornerstone of your home.
I would.
And your retirement plan. All right, folks. If you have questions about awards or how to display them, you can send them to us via our website, dinnerpartydownload.org.
Or via our hotline, a.k.a. the phone at our associate producer's cubicle. Bug him at 213-621-3470.
A torch to light the way.
And now it's time for the main course, where we talk about the best part of any dinner party, the food.
And Brendan, as you know, I think dogs are swell, but when it comes down to it, I'm a cat person.
That's right.
And that's how it is.
Which explains why you're always asking me to dangle a shoelace in front of your face.
I can't get enough.
You're easily distracted.
But yeah, I love cats. So imagine my delight when I learned this week North America got its first cat cafe.
Wow.
These are coffee shops that have been popular in Asia for years, where in addition to a nice cup of joe, you also get to hang out with friendly cats.
This is like a nightmare for people like me who are allergic.
I'm sorry for you, but lucky for you, it's way up in Montreal. You have nothing to worry about.
Okay.
Montreal also would account for the place's French name. It's called Café de Chat. I chatted with co-owner Nadine Spencer this week and first asked why she wanted to open the place.
It's something that's bound to do well, seeing as there's many people that either come here just for school, so for a very short period, or there's a lot of landlords that just don't allow pets in homes.
I see. So students, obviously, they can't get a pet because they're not around full time.
Exactly. Also, elderly people can't always take care of pets on their own either, so we wanted to reach out to pet lovers that didn't have the option of having one of their own, or that just wanted to have some company from us, some other fantastic felines.
Let's talk about these felines. Where do the cats come from? Are they lent by owners? Does the shop own them and care for them after hours?
No, they're our little kitties. We actually adopted all of the cats from the SPCA.
All right.
So they all are rescue cats, and we gave them a second chance.
Well, obviously you can get rescue cats that have serious problems. How did you screen these cats? What are you looking for in the perfect cafe cat?
Well, they did the first choice for us, and from those that were chosen, we went and picked the ones that we really fell in love with, that we saw had a good character, super friendly, and from there, once we had chosen all 8 of our cats, we do have 8, we kept them there in quarantine for about a month and a half to make sure that they were all healthy, that there was no issues, and that they were all friends with one another.
Yes, I was going to say, because that's the other thing. I mean, ironically, a lot of cats are very shy around lots of strangers, and also have a hard time around lots of cats, which is exactly the situation you're putting them in.
Oh, no. Everybody has just been commenting on how amazing the cats are. They're really exceptionally friendly. They love people. They love playing. And when they don't feel like doing so, they can just come and kind of go off and do their own thing. It is their home, after all. And we do have a little, I guess you could say, bedroom, cat room, that we built specially in the location. So if ever they don't feel like being social, they can just go and kind of hang out in there.
They can take a time out, basically.
A time out. There you go.
Well, then is it possible that I could go to the cat cafe and there just aren't any cats because they're all just like, I've had enough for today?
No, they're usually pretty much lounging around throughout the cafe. They rarely go to their room. Most of the time, they're just kind of chilling throughout the cafe on their cat trees or their cat beds.
You know, there's never been a cafe like this in North America. What was the reaction of, say, food safety and animal safety officials when you applied for the business license?
Well, it was all as new to them as it was to us, so it definitely took a little bit longer for them to come up with the rules and regulations. One of them being that the kitchen cannot be in the same area as the cats.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, a lot of no fur in the paninis.
Fur would be the least of my worries.
Well, and amongst other things. But they do their little business also in their bedroom. So that's behind a curtain, closed off from the public as well, so nobody has to smell any smelliness.
But what you know, we're talking about the cats and making sure that they don't, you know, affect the health of the humans. But what about the other way around? I mean, you can get crazy cat people. How do you screen for the humans?
There are rules that are set in place, so there's no picking up the cats unless one of the staff members hands them to you. There's no feeding the cats, obviously no rough and tough with the kitties, and if they're sleeping, then by all means they have to be left to sleep.
You have to go to the cats then, you can't pick them, you go to wherever they are, they can come into your lap or something.
Exactly.
Oh, it sounds adorable.
It is, I'm missing them being away from them right now.
But I do have to, it does make me wonder, the draw of this place obviously is the cats. Why even offer the cafe part of it? Couldn't you just have a vending machine in the corner and you'd have plenty of clientele?
People like to eat. But we keep our menu to very basic. We have paninis, croissants, chocolatines, pastries, but nothing extravagant on the menu. We really wanted to focus on the coffee and the kitties more so than anything else.
It is kind of a genius move, right? I mean, if there are two things that are probably booming, thanks in part to the internet, it's coffee culture and cat culture.
Exactly. So we hit them right on the nose.
My God, you're just going to be rolling in dough. I'm glad to meet you before you're a snooty millionaire. You've been open a week. What surprised you so far, maybe about the customers?
Well, we've actually, today is only our third day of business. We had a line down the street on Saturday, but they're very soft. So everybody's been asking, what do you do to their fur? And we feed them Royal Canine, which is an amazing brand, so they definitely get the best nutrition, and I think it must definitely come from that because they are soft as can be.
So you got eight cats. Is there one who's maybe the star?
I would definitely say they all have characters. King Kong is the eldest, the godfather. He's 5 1/2. He is massive, large, and in charge, if you will, but probably one of the most gentlest cats I've ever met in my life.
You named him King Kong.
It suits him. If you go online on our Facebook page, you'll see pictures, and you'll know what I mean when you take a look. We have Bigfoot, who is a polydactyl.
Oh, that means they have thumbs, kind of, right?
Yeah, little mitten thumbs. And I think he's the one in charge right now. He's kind of taken control of things, watching over all of the cats and keeping them in order.
Because he's, you know, evolutionarily, he could actually grow to be able to use tools.
Exactly. We had to actually, the door, instead of turning the doorknob down, we put it to turn up to avoid any kitty escapes. And he was one of the ones that we were worried about.
Sure, you could have a Dawn of the Planet of the Apes uprising going.
Yeah, exactly. We'll have an extra thumb and all. You never know.
Nadine Spencer, co-owner of Montreal's Café de Chat. This week it became the first cat cafe in North America.
Oh, man.
And Brendan, a couple years back, went to a cat cafe while visiting Tokyo.
This is a big surprise.
Yeah. It was basically that and temples, the only things on my list. Anyway, we have a slideshow of photos that I shot at that cafe, and these photos are so cute, they're going to break the internet completely. You'll find a link at our website, dinnerpartydownload.org.
And that's the Dinner Party Download for this week, everybody. While our party here is ending, it continues all week long on Twitter and on Instagram. Our handle for both is DinnerPartyDNLD.
Also, big news in case you missed it, we just joined a new podcast network from American Public Media. It's called Infinite Guest. Along with this very show, you will find 11 other shows to become obsessed with, including A Tiny Sense of Accomplishment with authors Sherman Alexie and Jess Walter, and Awesome Etiquette from our regular etiquette experts Lizzie Post and Daniel Post-Senning. Hear more at InfiniteGuest.org, where the conversation never ends. In a good way.
Sounds good. So is our associate producer, Jackson Musker. He helps keep our conversation going. Yeah. Brittany Martin is our social media whiz. Thanks also to Ravi Carmen, Garrett Lang, and Stephen Colon, who provided engineering help. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney.
And now, before we leave you, it's time for One for the Road, a song to listen to on your way to or returning from this week's dinner parties.
Barry Timoney, a force behind the bands Helium and Wild Flag, has a new project called X-Hex. The band's debut album, Rips, comes out October 7th. Here's a track from it called Don't Wanna Lose.
Bon appetit.
I thought you were a man of action.
Thanks for attending the Dinner Party Download. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano. A tasty mouse.
Rico, no!